Ave podcast listeners, a quick notice before we get started on today's episode. It's been a minute, but the When in Rome podcast is now fundraising again to keep the podcast going for an eighth season. If you give your support now, you get access to more than 80 archived episodes of the podcast, as well as previous limited series that we've released. I hope you consider it, as there's still a lot more of the Roman Empire left to explore. To celebrate, you're about to hear the final episode of the seventh series, a special interview with Sophie Hay and Stephen Ellis about excavating in Pompeii. You can find the fundraiser on Kickstarter, and there's a link in the show notes of this episode. Thanks, and on that note, Ave, and welcome to When in Rome. And now, cue the music. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. Far from home, all I got is you. When in Rome is a podcast about place and space in the Roman Empire. This is episode LXXXIII, Excavating Pompeii. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and my guests today are Sophie Hay, an archaeologist from the Archaeological Park of Pompeii, and Professor Stephen Ellis, who directs the University of Cincinnati's excavations at Pompeii. They were in Australia at the opening of a major exhibition on life in Pompeii, on display at the Australian National Museum until 4th of May. Pompeii has been excavated for hundreds of years, and in that time, techniques, practices, and philosophies have changed. We're now finding out a lot more about the city and the people who live there, and there's still more to find out. Here's Sophie Hay and Stephen Ellis. When it comes to excavating in Pompeii, what options are open and how do you choose where can be excavated? I'm just trying to get a handle of how much there is to find still and what's open and available. And what comes into account when you're trying to think of, let's dig here?
So with a research project, we typically start at the parts of the city that finished being exposed by the earliest excavators, whether it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years ago. Those kinds of decisions tend to be built on specific research questions that you have, either for a region of Pompeii or a neighbourhood of Pompeii or a building in Pompeii.
So from the park's point of view, obviously we have the privilege of digging from the very, very top of the volcanic material down to AD 79 levels. It's probably a little less about the research question as such, but more a strategy of maintenance of the park. And the recent big excavations, so Region 5 and now Region 9, which are the current excavations, plus we have House of Leda. These are all on the edge of the unexcavated part. So there's one third of the city is still completely untouched and is still full of volcanic material. And it's the edge of that between unexcavated and excavated that has become a risk area because we're having more rain, climate is changing, and there's a fear of collapse. So the whole strategy has been about conservation. It hasn't really technically been about let's go dig. It's how do we actually preserve what we've got, and we don't want these edges to collapse. So there's been a strategy to manage the water elements of this so that there's less chance that it will collapse, but also to step that excavation edge backwards to make it more stable. And with that, happily for us as well, nice kind of consequence of that is we get to dig quite large areas. In other areas, so the House of Leda, which is right at the north of the city, it's been quite a small little excavation just to kind of clear that edge. But then Region 9, it's the biggest excavation that's been happening in a generation.
There'd be elements to both of it, though, wouldn't there?
Yeah, no, of course. We're not interested in what we're finding. It's how we're planning to do excavation is not based on, well, if we dig here, we might learn about this, which is exactly what Stephen is looking at. He wants to answer specific questions and he's spotted the best place that he could potentially get answers from. We'll just dig and find what we find. And obviously it's fantastic. We need to protect site. This is a kind of functional attitude we have, and with it comes the beauty. And obviously we absolutely adore what we're finding. I mean, no worries about that. We are completely hooked on the stories that are coming out of the new excavations. What motivates us is very different.
And Stephen, what are your excavations? How do you choose a site that or an area that you would like to have a closer look at?
The University of Cincinnati excavations. What we did was we approached an area of the city that had been cleared out about 100 years ago. What we had then was exposed buildings, and these buildings we could see from the shapes of them, from the architecture, from the rooms, from the whole structures, that it was a kind of a sub-elite neighborhood of the city. It didn't have the same kinds of large atrium-style, elite-style houses that we found in a lot of other parts of the city. So that at once was the attraction for our excavations, was to come and look at a neighborhood of multiple buildings, neighbor by neighbor, one side of the street to the other. What is their story? What is their history? So because the volcanic debris that had buried this neighborhood had been cleared before us, we had a chance to then dig down below the floors. So by digging below the floors, we were able to uncover earlier buildings, the earlier shapes to the present buildings that are there in 79 CE, and to ultimately tell this story from the bottom to the top of how that neighborhood came to be in the shape that it was in when it was buried by Mount Vesuvius in 79 CE.
I think what's great about these two different approaches is we get then the full story, because we take you down to 79 levels, mm-hmm. and then the research project come in, they pick us up at 79, and they take us all the way back to potentially the 6th century BC. Yeah. It's a kind of beautiful sort of marriage of these two approaches, but in the end we get the full story of Pompeii.
Right, and the symbiosis continues because we get our surprises. We come in with these specific questions and we approach the site with this question to try to answer those questions, but at the same time we're also finding things we never expected to find. You could never imagine finding. We dig through these different phases, these different chapters in the history of Pompeii, but we're also finding new questions.
So, Stephen, do you look at the site that the park is now excavating and go, oh, I'd really like to get my trowel on that kind of site?
Oh, of course. Who wouldn't want to do that kind of excavation from the top down? But, you know, we, the sort of relatively recent history since the Second World War, we never really had that opportunity nor really wanted it. We were quite happy with this opportunity to start with that part of the city that had been cleared away and then to just take things a little bit more slowly, a little bit more methodically, kind of strategically, to answer specific kinds of questions we would have had about that building or that town block. To have had the opportunity to have dug it from the top down would be great, but it's also a very different physical process. It requires a different investment, I think. So the work that's happening from the park is at an engineering scale that could never really be properly matched by a university research project. We have a decent budget, we have a great team of people, but we're also limited to, say, you know, 2 months of a summer to do that kind of project. So it's a very different scale of project and a very different kind of motivation behind it.
It's a sort of logistical nightmare, and I watch it and I absolutely enthralled when I watch it, because you've got the architects coming in, the engineers coming in to discuss how do you put a sort of temporary roof on this. You've got collapsed walls or partly collapsed walls that need propping up by scaffold. As you come down, you reveal some nice sort of decorated plaster or even plain plaster. You need a team of conservators that come in. They don't dig a whole room and then do conservation. These things are all happening at the same time. Universities don't have that money. And, mm-hmm. you know, this excavation now in Region 9, for instance, it's been going on for over a year and a half. You know, there's no way.
Different kind of world.
Which is magical because, as I said, then we get the full story, but, you know, from two different elements, sort of sides. It's great. Everyone wins.
You must, at times when you're doing this, reflect on what might have been lost from previously excavated areas now that your excavation techniques have changed and how you're conserving it has changed. So if Region 9 was excavated 100 years ago, you would now have lost quite a lot of detail, I guess, on the walls and graffiti and those kind of things not being maybe properly recorded. So can you take me through your thought process when it comes to that sort of stuff?
Yeah, no, I think a lot would have changed, you know, from 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And we think we're at the sort of the top level now. This is what's going to be quite interesting, is what happens in 100 years when they look back at what we've done. Are they going to go, oh my God, you know, they didn't keep all the soil, or they didn't keep every single piece of pumice, which can now reveal all of this information. So, you know, we think we're at the top of our game now. And that's what our approach is to exactly do that. We 3D scan things. You know, the record of it is impeccable. But I guess, yeah, no, in terms of like physical things that we would be missing, I think one of the most interesting things from Region 9 is that we found that it's a building site. And the nice thing now is that it's still a building site. We are still kind of putting scaffolding up and there are builders repairing the walls and conservators doing the plaster. But we found so much evidence of the Romans having a building site. Piles of lime mortar, just kind of white mounds lying on the floor. There's cocio pesto, which is crushed up, pesto meaning kind of crushed up, cocio meaning fragments of pottery. They crush them up, they add a mortar to it, and they make floors out of it. It's really hard wearing. You see the floors all over Pompeii in use, but I'd never seen the raw material kind of waiting to be laid. So we're learning about, A, the economy, how things are delivered, how building materials are delivered. And we're seeing all these little details that we are missing in the rest of Pompeii, but we know. We know that they were there. I mean, there are certain piles of lime, I have to say, around Pompeii, but the range we have of different qualities, different mixes. We have black sand, which they would have probably used for flooring. We have an amphora that's just full of little white tessera, so the little white stones that make up a mosaic. So these people were preparing to refloor, replaster, rebuild the walls. And yeah, we're seeing this economy. There was a pile of oyster shells in a doorway of one of the rooms that we've excavated. And they think that they would have crushed up those oyster shells to get the sort of shiny, glittery material type thing. And they would have finished the plaster decoration with that to give it a kind of a sheen. But they're not bringing in the powdered form. They're bringing in the actual shells. So it may have been cheaper to just buy the shells and they crush them up themselves rather than buy in a powder that could have been more expensive. Or maybe that was how it was done. You just got the whole oyster shell. So we're seeing these like little details, and we've had people from MIT in America coming to have a look, study the materials. And so we're getting, yeah, this amazing kind of microscopic view of a building site. We have roof tiles all piled up next to each other, waiting to be used to repair the roof. People think when they come and visit, we open it to the public each weekday, and the public just think, oh, that's where the archaeologists have left the roof tiles, you know, out of the way. And we're like, no, no, this is exactly how we found them. And it is amazing. And a pile of bricks, someone was waiting to use them and repair a wall, and yet never did. But yeah, these kind of little details, they're kind of magical because it gives the property life. And I think a lot of people come to Pompeii and think that it's pristine. Everyone had just painted their walls 2 days before the eruption and it's all clean. But it wasn't. This house is a mess. It's got piles of building materials sitting in the most beautiful room of the house, should be anyway, because there's a bakery next door. There's a millstone that's been moved and it's sitting in essentially what would be your living room. You know, everything's a bit of a mess and it's kind of beautiful because for me, I can just see builders shouting at each other saying, you know, pass me the spade, pass me the water, whatever. It just comes alive much more to me than a sort of pristine, perfect house.
You know, I think the magic you're talking about is this is all from these most recent excavations that Sophie's a part of from the park. And from our generation of archaeologists, we were there just before these new excavations began. We were always operating in a city, learning about different parts of the city, but a city that had been exposed, that had been dug earlier, most recent, maybe 50 years earlier, or in many cases up to 250 years earlier. So these amazing levels of detail that Sophie's talking about the state of the city, about how it looked in 79 CE, but also how it looked when those first excavators 250 years ago came and exposed the site. That for us as archaeologists working in the city is an absolute dream. I couldn't have dreamed of seeing this kind of thing. I was doing my graduate work, for example, say 20 years ago, walking around Pompeii, studying the city, wishing we could have engaged with a city that was being dug from the top down, seeing what Pompeii looked like by those first excavators. All we had were old journals. They were pretty good, right? And you know, oil paintings. To think that we now have today this new opportunity, even though they're only taking a fraction, we can sort of take that fraction of the city and stretch it over all the parts that we'd otherwise lost. Because the city's worn. The city's worn, it's torn, so much of it has been lost to the elements. It is magic, yeah, to be able to have this moment in time in Pompeian archaeology that we've never seen before.
Yeah, no, and even if we find a skeleton, I mean, we keep the skeleton as a complete body. Mm. And of course, everyone will think, of course you do, it's a person. 100 years ago, they weren't, not even that much, even probably 50 odd years ago, they probably weren't. They were keeping all the skulls in one place, all the leg bones in another. And we can never marry those people back together again. We can never make a complete person out of that. But because now we are obviously in a position where we can do studies on these people, we can even attempt DNA is just starting. These weren't even considerations 50 years ago. So there was no idea that you should keep a body together because it kind of didn't matter.
Yeah.
So, you know, as technology moves on, our research questions change and then we start looking at things differently. And yeah, the people who are excavating 100, 200 years ago weren't interested in a pile of lime. It got in the way of the nice floor beneath it. That's what they wanted to reveal. That's what they thought Pompeii was about. It's about the grandeur and splendor. It's not about a pile of building rubble. It's not exciting. It wasn't romantic. But now for us, we're like, absolutely, this is a clue to, you know, a whole other strand of life of the Romans. Great.
Even entire buildings. So 200 years ago, you excavate a house, a nice house, alongside a crummy shop right next to it. 200 years ago, one of those buildings gets a lot more attention and a lot more effort towards conservation, even 200 years old versions of conservation, roofing structures and things like this, than today. Today, we can find in these excavations shops and houses, and they're getting the same kind of treatment. So it's not just the technology, it's the mindset to all of this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Region 9 is actually, the current excavations really display this, because right next to them are excavations that happened 50, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, and the walls are bare. There's no roofs over anything. And then we see the riches and what we can gather from where we are, and we think, what have we lost? There's a chasm of things we've lost. But then it's part of the history of the site too. I mean, it started with looting and tunneling and destruction of artifacts that royal families, if they didn't want it in their palaces, they destroyed because they didn't want anybody else to have it either. What are the politics and the reasons for being there and digging is how you look after it afterwards.
Can I ask a couple of questions that have come to me while you guys have been talking? I've got some technical questions that I'd just like to think about. When you come across a wall with lovely frescoes in it, that's nicely decorated, that is nice and bright, as soon as you expose those sort of things to the elements, just over time, they're going to wear out. And we've seen that sort of thing happen around Pompeii as well. How do you decide what you leave in place? How do you conserve it? And how do you decide what's going to go into a museum?
So at the moment, nothing gets taken off the wall. We leave absolutely everything in situ, unless it falls off, which it hasn't so far. We leave all frescoes in situ. This is, we are not collecting objects to house somewhere else. Obviously, in terms of frescoes, obviously, but the finds, most of them get taken to the lab. They need to be conserved themselves, stabilized, put in a good temperature, etc. But the conservation process on the walls is all about keeping them in situ, which is hugely important. It's beautiful to go to the museum in Naples. You get to see these amazing frescoes, but you have no context for them whatsoever. They are just pictures as we would have on the walls, and you forget that they are part of an entire scheme in a room. That room may play against another room in the house. You know, the Romans don't do things by accident when they decorate. They're playing on themes, ideas, colours, whatever it is. And so I think it's so important that people see it in context. And visitors now that go to the House of the Vetti, which has reopened after 15, 20 years, everyone's jaw just drops, because there you are in the sort of dimensions and space of a Roman house. They've got really beautifully reconstructed roofs now, very kind of in keeping with as much as we can with the Roman period, but you see it in that light, you see it in the space. It's a completely different experience.
And it changes the perspective too, because now that we can see not just an individual wall painting with all of its, you know, beautiful execution, right? A piece of art. When you see it in the room, against a wall, in a room, within a building, and then you start to see the buildings all around it and the neighborhood around it and the city around it, you start to see the wall paintings not just as pieces of art, which they are, of course, but you see them as an industry, because there's just an incredible scale of wall paintings. And I think that's something that's really come to the fore, at least from my mind, when I think about now that the city walking around, you just see so much of the, every square inch of the city has some kind of form of decoration, from banal to something quite museum worthy.
Exactly. Yeah. I love the fact that they take the time to make sure they stay in place. I think it's so important for learning, understanding. If you take anything out of context, you're removing half, maybe more of its story.
In the same kind of vein, then, how are you dealing with bodies? I mean, you said that you're keeping them all together, but there's still plaster casts made, I guess, when appropriate or when able. Can you talk me through that? Have you been finding many in that region?
Yeah, so the casts can only be made in certain conditions. If the person is at a very low level in Pompeii, usually they are covered with the pumice stone, the lapilli, and in which case we cannot make a cast. It's like covering a body with little sort of polystyrene packaging material. There's no way we could make a cast. We find their skeleton. If, however, they are killed by the pyroclastic flow, so this sort of very hot ash and gas that comes from the collapse of the eruption column, that material settles around the body, they die, it hardens over time, the body decomposes, we get a void left in exactly the shape, the sort of 3D proportions of the body. And when we're digging, we just find a little hole. You fill that void with plaster, wait for it to set, and then we chip away the ash around it. First of all, you can't have a cast of every single body. It's, you know, we don't always get the choice. We do have an anthropologist on site who will sometimes make a decision on whether she thinks that if a cast is possible, whether it's worthwhile, in the sense that by making a cast, you have to remove as many bones as possible before you make the cast. Otherwise, you're going to have bones in the cast and you lose all that information about that person, their sex, their age, their diet, health, all the things that can help us understand the Roman people better. And also they may be carrying objects. And some of the people we've been finding recently, it's been very interesting to see what they're carrying on their person. And again, there's a risk if you make a cast that you might lose that. So the last casts we made were in Civita Giuliana, which is a suburban villa, so a big villa site outside the walls of Pompeii. The first cast they made there was of a horse, 2.5 horses, I think. Depends on the success rate. In those rooms in particular, they had been closed off. No pumice had entered. So at ground level, it was ash. And so to see the scale of one of these horses kind of volumetrically was really impressive, actually, I have to say. It changes your idea about the scale of an animal. These horses were unusually large, which probably means they weren't pack animals, but they were probably used for military purposes along that line rather than workhorses, if you like. So that was quite interesting. And we did take casts of 2 people there. But in the recent excavations in both the Insula of the Chaste Lovers, which is also in Region 9, and the dig we call Region 9, we've kept them as skeletons. And in one particular room, there was a woman who had a lot of possessions on her. She'd obviously gone and collected as much portable wealth as she could pick up. It's kind of quite emotive to see it happening as well. The casts, I don't know how you feel about the casts, Stephen, but there's something I find quite hard about the casts because they're so good, I guess. To me, they embody too much of tortuous, hideous end of life. And they talk to me less about who this person was when they were alive and running around. That's why I do archaeology. I like to know what they were doing when they were healthy and at least alive. And there's something so powerful about the casts. They sort of stop me in my tracks. I don't know how you feel.
I mean, they're a necessary reminder.
Yes.
That we're dealing with a cataclysmic event. And so I get caught up in the same. And our research is often about the development of a city and the shape of a city and all these urban kinds of questions. But we're also working on a city that was destroyed, in which, you know, thousands of people had a horrible end. And so it could be easy for us, spending so much time at Pompeii, to become desensitized to that kind of event. Those casts definitely help us to snap back to that reality of what happened.
for us as well, I guess, for the anthropologist, the skeleton, its form. I mean, I sat one afternoon watching her excavate one of the bodies that's literally just come out from the Region 9 excavations, and it was a woman who had fallen or was falling off a bed. On her person, she had a little purse, so we found traces of the little fabric purse or little bag that she had, and inside that was a series of coins, but also little amulets, one of which would have been given to a woman when she was a small, small baby, and you kind of wear it until you get married. It's called a lunula. And obviously it was a very sentimental item. But when you see it sort of with the person, it means a lot more to me than if they'd kind of grabbed it, made a cast, and you've just got this thing. I don't know, it just, it was a very different experience. And what was great, she also had under her other arm, she really went for it, I think, when she was collecting her items. She had a little wooden box. We found traces of a little iron lock with little bits of traces of wood. And inside that, there were a series of, I think, 6 gold coins. And they come out of the ground pristine. Mm-hmm. It kind of collapses time a little bit when you find these things. But the amazing thing about the coin was, because they're so legible when they come out, usually you've got a little, we used to call them Smarties, green Smarties. You have a little bronze coin, really illegible, can't see it. But with gold, you can see all the detail immaculately. And one of the archaeologists who took it to kind of bag it up and record it said, oh my goodness, we've got a coin of Domitian. Well, hang on.
What?
Wait, what? And we were like, who rings the director now on a Friday night at 6 o'clock in the evening to tell him not to worry about the date of the month of Pompeii's the eruption, but maybe the year? So no, in the end, luckily, someone spotted that it was actually Domitian when he was still princeps. And so it was 77
oh,
AD.
Oh, right.
But we were all just stopped in our tracks for a moment.
Yeah.
Quite the moment to be on site. You know, but it's lovely because you have those discussions while things are coming out. The anthropologist is working out, you know, the contortion of the body, what happened to her. She's constantly sort of working out. She thought even there was a hand close to her mouth. The anthropologist thinks that she may have had some material in her hand to kind of help combat the gases that were coming out. So you suddenly, yeah, you do get those like little personal details of horror, obviously, but they make it much stronger to me than than a cast.
It's hard for us to imagine the scale of that horror too, that these casts represent. They're, of course, the physicality of it, they are being buried alive in this scorching hot volcanic material. So there's a physicality to it, of course, that is horrendous to think about. But there's also just this idea of a natural catastrophe that's happening. It's not like a natural catastrophe like we might have today, right? So with all due respect to people who deal with natural catastrophes, a volcanic eruption of this kind, not only have they never experienced, they could never have even imagined. So in that moment, they're not just seeing this mountain exploding, their town being rained upon, being buried in that moment. It had to have been the entire world for them coming to an end. And just coming back to this idea of what do these plaster casts mean to us, I think, you know, it's important to really think hard about and think more about what does it mean to be buried by a volcanic eruption when no such thing had ever happened.
I do want to know what you're hoping to find in Pompeii. If you could answer one question to come out of digs in the future, what that would be?
Oh my goodness, that's the
It's a great question, but it's a really hard question because you've got a combination of, you know, what is there of the physical city that you would hope to find on the one hand, and then what academic questions do we hope to answer on the other as well?
Yeah.
So whatever we find is going to be interesting,
right?
So it's not as though we're waiting still for some kind of dream find to befall us. I mean, there's a few little things here and there. I always thought it'd be great if Pompeii had something like what Rome had, which was a marble plan of its city. Now, I'm not saying Pompeii did have that or would have that, but if it did have that, I want to find that. You know, there are, of course, all these different kinds of questions that we each have for our areas of research. But again, you know, one of the lessons I think I've learned from my own excavations at the city that we came with certain questions and left with a whole bunch of other questions and answers, right? There's always going to be something new underground that you just can't expect that you'll ever find. And it opens up so many pathways, so many doorways. It's less for me about what do we hope to find, but what do we hope to do with what we find?
The point of us digging overall is if we knew what was down there, we wouldn't need to dig.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point of excavation is to kind of uncover something, and like you say, go down a new rabbit hole is actually probably more exciting than finding exactly what you wanted to find. For me, though, if I found something, it's a bit along your lines. I always said that I'd like to find a planning office because I did my PhD on how property boundaries changed over time through Pompeii, who stole whose garden, whatnot. I would love to find all the planning office records, and I'd go through them. And obviously, if I got something wrong in my PhD, I'd lose them. But yeah, no, I think the joy really is not really knowing what you're going to find.
What about your favourite finds then that have come out of the current excavations? I mean, I'm quite a sucker for graffiti on the walls. I always like a good bit of graffiti. I read about a small dog coming out that was fully grown, which indicates that they were breeding them to be that size, which I found quite interesting about that area. So what do you like that you've seen come out?
I do agree with you. I love the written word. I love images sort of scrawled onto the wall because these aren't official inscriptions, you know, that the emperor has told someone to chisel and put on the wall of the forum. Graffiti, things like that, they are the unedited voices of the masses. Anyone with a sharp implement can make their mark. And I kind of love it exactly that. You get a connection with a person. Even standing in front of it, you know that person stood right there and spent time standing right where your feet are. And for me, these things are kind of really emotive and they form a connection with these people who I want to study. I don't know what my favourite find is, but it's going to be something like a pile of lime or something, right? Because it's about process. You're seeing action. You're seeing change. It's about the sort of bigger picture of life. It's not a single beautiful, you know, earring. They are beautiful. The gold coin, stunning. But there's something, I don't know.
I think for us with the Cincinnati excavations, because we were digging down through the city that had been cleared out of all the stuff that was there in 79 CE, and we were digging through the layers that built up those buildings over time. So what we're mostly finding, the bits and pieces of broken things that are collected to make new layers, to make new floors, to make walls, to make structures. And so the stuff that we're getting, it sounds like a bumper sticker, but it's all trash, right? So we're finding lots of that. And so what that means is it's less about the individual objects. There's always little bits of interesting bits of coins here and bits of interesting pottery there. But it's all broken. And it's being used by the city, discarded, and then reused to then make the next layer of change, of development of the city. My answer is less about the singular object that is the most interesting thing to find. It's typically the idea or the interpretation. That's the fun part of all of this. That moment on the project, either in the trench or either in the library, where it starts to make sense. The idea starts to form and then the penny drops and you've got it. Really, it's the ideas and the interpretations that's the most exciting part of that archaeological process.
There was one thing that came out of Region 9, a marble top table in a very nondescript room, and everything was still upright in place, exactly as they had left it. So there was two glass flasks, a Samian bowl upside down, covering a glass plate with some kind of, essentially black goo now, but it's being analysed. There was a bronze lamp, there was one coin, a bronze vessel, but it was absolutely stunning to see as they would have had it. Nothing had toppled over, nothing had fallen. But what was really interesting was once the conservators had cleared the table, they picked up the marble table top. They moved it, they turned it over to see if there, you know, had been reused marble, maybe with a nice map of Pompeii underneath. And then suddenly we got this whiff of degrading textile, organic, rotting smell. And there must have been something, maybe cushioning the marble on the wood or something that had decomposed. But we got this smell and someone just went, "That's the smell of the past." And we're all sort of like, we're all going to have some sort of nasty disease. It's going to be like Tutankhamun. We're all going to be cursed now. I mean, you had to be there. That's not an object you can put in a display case. it was phenomenal, I have to say. It is the privilege of my job to see that side too.
Yeah.
So you're both in Canberra at the moment at the opening of the new exhibition at the Australian National Museum. What did you think of the exhibition when you first saw it?
I walked in and cried. So that was a good reaction. I'm absolutely blown away by it. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant exhibition in the sense that it has a bit of everything. But I think for me, the main thing, not only does it really remind me of being in Pompeii itself, it's got objects, but it's also got a lot of huge visual experiences, including videos of actually people working on site. And I think you can go to a museum and you can see all these beautiful objects, but these videos really capture how these objects come to be exactly where you're looking at them. Again, it's the context. I'm obsessed with context. And I think you can go to a million exhibitions or a million museums, see these objects, but have no idea where they've come from, who dug them up, how they were dug up, and how they are now in front of you. Half of the exhibition has ancient daily life, and the other half, current excavations, the process of getting these things from the ground, the process on site of discovering, trying to understand what they're there for. It brings an energy to all the objects. They are not just static, standalone things. They become part of a bigger story. You get the energy of the people finding them. I think it's really inspirational for people to see, goodness, maybe I could do that one day. I could be an archaeologist. That's a job. I didn't have that growing up. My parents took me to museums and I looked at endless cases of Greek vases, but I had no idea of how they got there, where they came from. And this exhibition really puts it all into context in a really dramatic, engaging, exciting, dynamic way.
Yeah, I'd say that, the Pompeii exhibition at the National Museum of Australia, it's something incredibly special. You know, I think, Sophie and I, we can be so easily desensitized to a lot of this material. We work in Pompeii, we live in Pompeii, we're surrounded by all things Pompeian. But when we walk into that exhibition here in Canberra, it takes our breath away. What's being curated by Lily Withicombe, what's being brought in, these sort of 90 objects, it's the collection of them, it's the arrangement of them, it's the information provided with them. As an exhibition, it just holds together so much information that really invites you to think about the past and to connect to the past. There's a real immediacy, but to come face to face now here in Canberra with these objects that a Pompeian themselves had come face to face with, you can't really kind of emphasize just how special that moment can really be to all of us. Whoever you are, there's something for you in that Pompeian experience. So I've never seen anything like it.
That was Sophie Hay and Stephen Ellis, and you have been listening to When in Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like When in Rome on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Blue Sky. Sophie is at Pompeii79, Stephen is at Stephen Ellis, I am at NightlightGuy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. When in Rome is a publicly funded podcast, and I'd like to give a sincere thanks to those who have supported it. The Emperata for this episode is Lisa Rosenthal, and our triumvirs, as always, are Ken Acusti, Dean Pavitt, and Lorenzo Marasco. Ave to you. Also, a shout out to Ollie Julian, the composer of the music that you're listening to in this podcast. It's the theme music to the ITV show Plebs from Rise Comedy. That's it today for When in Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.